Welcome to this episode of Entangled With, the podcast about quantum technologies for scientists and science enthusiasts. This episode is being hosted by me, Julian, and Mike, two first-year PhD students at the University of Bristol's Quantum Engineering Centre for Doctoral Training. Today's guest is Alex Kissinger, Associate Professor of Quantum Computation at the University of Oxford. In this episode, we mainly talk about quantum picturalism, or how to use diagrams to reason about quantum processes. We hope that you'll find this episode enjoyable. And now let's jump into Entangled With Alex Kissinger. Welcome, Alex. It's nice having you on the podcast.
Yeah, nice to be here.
As a start, can you please introduce yourself and maybe also tell us how you ended up at Oxford?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Alex Kissinger. I'm an associate professor at Oxford in computer science, associate professor of quantum computing. It's kind of funny how I ended up here, which was I came over from the U.S. I'm from Oklahoma originally, and I came on a two-month exchange program. So the idea was just to come to Oxford and sort of party for 2 months and then go home and start my life in Oklahoma. But then decided to stay for a master's and then for a PhD, did some postdocs also here. Then I spent a spell in the Netherlands at Radboud University as a professor of quantum structures and logic. And then I ended up back here in 2019. So two months sort of translated into 15 years.
Great. So how did you get interested in quantum computing then?
Well, when I first came to Oxford, I was very interested in category theory. Which is this branch of very pure mathematics, or used to be very pure mathematics. It's getting more applied these days. And I was taking a course by Samson Abramsky on called Categories, Proofs, and Programs. And toward the end of that course, there was this guest lecture by a really weird-looking guy called Bob Kuka. And he talked about his joint work with Samson, drawing diagrams and using category theory and applying it to quantum theory. So I got in touch with Samson after that and asked what sorts of stuff were going on in Oxford around this. And at the time there was something called quantum lunch where everyone would go for pub lunches on Wednesdays, and have a huge pub lunch and some pints and then go and try to stay awake while somebody talked about quantum computing. So I started coming to this thing and I didn't really understand anything, but I sort of hung around long enough until I did. That's kind of what got me into quantum. So I knew what a push out was before I knew what the double slit experiment was. So I had a kind of unusual introduction to quantum computing. These days moving more toward practical things in quantum software. So thinking a lot about quantum circuits and optimizing quantum circuits and so on. And I think that categorical stuff, from back then kind of influenced the way I think about a lot of these things still. Even though often there's not a whole lot of explicit category theory in the stuff I do anymore. There's still lots of these same kinds of pictures that were getting drawn back then.
Yeah, I recently discovered category theory and found like really surprising connections between it and programming, which was like really fascinating. So you mentioned Bob, and you two have a book together called Picturing Quantum Processes, and I want to talk about it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Your book, from what I understand, tries to answer the question, what is the most appropriate language to reason about quantum theory?
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask, so why is it we need a new language to talk about quantum theory? And what was the previous one and why it wasn't appropriate?
That's a good question. So the new language, picturing quantum processes means that the new language is actually a language of pictures. So the reason that pictures are somehow better or more suited to working with, to even to doing calculations in quantum theory, is actually fairly simple. And that's because the kinds of things you work with, especially in quantum computing, like quantum circuits and so on, are fundamentally at least two-dimensional objects. So there's two ways you can put things together. You can sort of compose gates and sequence, or you can put them side by side. And this is not something that's really unique to quantum theory. You see this in a lot of places where you can compose things in sequence or in parallel. So even, you know, things like electrical circuits or concurrent processes or all these sorts of things have these two kinds of ways you can compose things. And the problem with what you might call the traditional language of quantum theory, which I would say is just the kind of basically just the linear algebra you learned in school, or maybe just Dirac notation, which is the kind of thing you'd learn in a quantum computing course. The problem with this kind of language is it's one dimensional. So you take this thing which has this parallel and sequential composition, and then you squish it onto a line. You have to write things in this kind of symbolic notation. You squash it onto a line, and this makes it quite awkward to work with. So for instance, if you're trying to prove that quantum teleportation works, the idea behind it, if you just draw the picture, is very simple. You see this, well, the picture in the book is you have a little sort of zigzag piece of string, and you just pull it straight. And the way things are set up and formalized in the book, this makes sense, and this is actually a rigorous calculation, and it's totally obvious why this would work. But if you do this in Dirac notation or something, so how you would in a normal course in quantum information, it's not hard, but it takes, you know, two or three pages, depending on how small you write, to actually do this calculation at that kind of level of detail. So this is an example of something which should be totally obvious, which is not obvious in the standard notation. And then as you start to move to things which are not obvious at all, you can still follow them pretty well using the pictures. I think you can really see what's going on. You can see what's connected to what, and really not only follow derivations, but also see new things you can do while you're manipulating these structures, in a way that you just completely can't, when everything's kind of squashed into this 1D formula. So yeah, that's the kind of idea behind our claim. There's even a chapter in the book called something like Diagrams Rule or Diagrams Beat Algebra or something, where we show some examples to kind of bring this point home.
Yeah, I really liked your teleportation example because it shows the power of abstraction and how it is important to look at something in the right way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. Expressing things at the correct level of abstraction lets you see structures that you wouldn't if you didn't do that.
Can I ask a quick question about these using pictures instead of algebra? Do you think it's got anything to do with the fact that humans are quite visual creatures, that it just sort of makes more sense to us if we use pictures instead of symbols on mathematical symbols on a piece of paper? Do you think that's got anything to do with it?
Yeah, I think if anything, you're taking advantage of something that we're good at. Or to put another way, the way we normally do mathematics is really wasting our eyes in some sense, in that it's almost like you're trying to communicate these complicated multi-dimensional ideas using almost like Morse code, if you see it as all just sort of strung together in a big string. Whereas if you just look at a sheet of paper, we have so much more ability to perceive what's going on there that we should really make use of in our mathematics. And actually, related to that, so Bob has a new project with Stefano Goggioso, where they've written a book geared at high schoolers, and the idea is really to see if this pictorial note way of working with quantum theory is really superior as a way of teaching people, and especially I think as you start to focus on younger kids, you do start to see that visual aspect playing more and more of a role in helping people get it, I think, faster.
So this quantum picturalism idea is based on diagrams, right? And then we said things like quantum teleportation sort of jump out at you straight away when you use this new type of notation. Mm-hmm. But can it also be used to just solve problems you would do, say, in a physics class, in a quantum physics class? So, for example, one thing that you do at the start, say, in like second year in undergrad, is you would try and find like the eigenenergies and the eigenstates of the hydrogen atom, something like that. Mm-hmm. And you would normally use Dirac notation. And it seems to be, well, I don't know, that's the only way that I did it. So it seems, I can't imagine using pictures to do that. So is there a way that you can use this picturalism and get numbers out of it?
Yeah, so I wouldn't claim that the pictures are the kind of end all be all. You know, every tool has its problems that it's good at and its problems that are not good at. So I mean, if you're doing some calculation in a first quantum mechanics course and you find yourself drawing a triple integral and you know, doing this sorts of stuff, you know, maybe there's a good way to do it with pictures, but I don't know about it yet. However, I think there is a kind of misconception that you don't get numbers out. So actually often what you are calculating with these pictures is a number. So the way things are set up in picturing quantum processes and more generally in this approach, is that if I have something, say with n wires in and n wires out, then this represents a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix, which is the kinds of things you're always working with, say, if you have lots of qubits or something. So a consequence of that is a 2 to the 0 by 2 to the 0 matrix is a 1 by 1 matrix, which is just a number. And a very common way of working with this tool is you just kind of plug all your free wires, and now you have something with no wires in or out. And this is a number, or this represents a number. And you start working on this and simplifying and you get something, you get literally a number out of this, just following the rules of the pictures of the graphical calculus. And this kind of technique is quite fruitful for things like doing a classical simulation of quantum circuits, where you're kind of mixing what you could say is like this, you know, first course in quantum mechanics style of calculation of say amplitudes or something with the graphical calculus, and that's something that actually works quite well.
Yeah. Okay, so these diagrams are what you call, based on what you call these process theories. So they're like, mm-hmm. a process theory that focus on like interactions rather than states, or like what happens instead of what is. And me being a computer scientist, I really like this because it's like a natural thing for me, because all I do is write programs, which are just like interactions. But I understand that this is not a standard practice in many disciplines, and for example, physics.
Mm-hmm.
So first, can you just briefly describe what is a process theory and maybe give some examples?
First I'll tell you what a process is. A process is anything that has some inputs and some outputs. And then normally we would give these inputs and outputs some kind of type. So like you say, coming from programming, this probably is familiar if you've done something like typed, you know, a programming language with types, where a type could be a qubit or a register of qubits, or You know, in another theory, it could be, I don't know, the type of potatoes, and a process takes a potato as an input and makes French fries as output. So a process, that's all we say about processes. You know, they have some inputs and outputs, and these inputs and outputs have types. Now, what a process theory is really just a kind of universe you're working in. So a collection of processes that make sense to put together. So for instance, it doesn't make sense to plug, you know, to plug a potato into a C program or something like that, right? An example of a process theory would be like the theory of quantum processes, or you might call them like quantum channels. And as long as the dimensions match or something, it always makes sense to plug two quantum channels together to get a bigger quantum channel. But there's other examples. So there's these kind of silly theories of physical stuff. So we often use this cooking process theory as a way to teach this, because often with cooking, you're doing things in sequence and in parallel. You're kind of frying the carrots while you boil the potatoes and this sort of thing. But other examples could be, you know, the theory of programs written in a particular programming language. Some people say category, but there's this process theory, which is called like Hask of, you know, Haskell programs. And things like electrical circuits, you can fit these into process theories, and classical functions, probabilistic functions, and sort of Markov process type things. There's lots. And if you do like category theory, the kind of category theory way of saying process theory is what's called a symmetric monoidal category. And there's lots of those things around as well. Well, I mean, they're more or less synonymous, but we tend to, I think when we say process theory, we're focusing more on the diagrammatic aspects rather than the sort of formal category theory. I mean, that's basically what a process theory is.
It sounds like that sort of encompasses everything. Like, I can't really think of an example of something that doesn't have inputs and outputs that are a certain type. Do you have an example of something that isn't a process theory, or something that doesn't fit into that framework?
So there's some examples of things which could maybe be put into that framework, but somehow they don't. They might not quite work. So one of the examples I can think of is Feynman diagrams. Actually, the diagrams themselves are a perfectly good process theory, because you can really plug these things together and you can do whatever you like. But there's some kind of, you get into some kind of formal trouble of defining a process theory of path integrals, basically just because if you plug things together in a way that doesn't make sense, you get kind of divergences and stuff. You might still claim that this is a process theory, but it's kind of with a footnote of, you know, be careful. You don't always get a good process out just by plugging things any way you like, which is kind of what I would say makes a nice process theory is I take my boxes and I plug them in however I like, or at least in any acyclic way I like. And the thing that describes is a good process. So I would say that's the kind of the bare minimum of something that's a process theory, or at least a nice process theory.
So this might be obvious from what you've just said, but why did you decide to take these process theories as your starting point?
It's kind of hard to say. Like I said, so picturing quantum processes isn't really explicitly a category theory book, but the category theory kind of influenced the way we think about this stuff. And one of the things one of the kind of core concepts there, which is something that you mentioned, was this idea that the process is fundamental, and the system or the types or the state spaces, these are kind of secondary. Like, these are only interesting because there's processes between them. And I think this idea, so in category theory, they would say that the morphism is kind of everything. So in category theory lingo, like, your state spaces or your systems are called objects, and your maps between them are called morphisms. And the kind of motto there is that the morphisms matter, and the objects really only tell you what morphisms make sense to plug together. And I think this idea really resonated with us. And I think it's especially a good way of thinking about quantum theory, where so much is about interaction. So if you think about sort of studying quantum systems kind of in isolation, you lose all of the cool stuff. You know, you lose entanglement, non-locality, and quantum advantage, and all of these sorts of things come from the interactions between many systems together. And those interactions will fundamentally be processes. I think that's how you will see that interaction taking place. So I think that's why this is such a fruitful way to think about things.
Yeah, I really like that, because I don't know. So I came from a purely computer science background before I joined the CDT, and I hadn't done anything quantum. And then I started reading these books about quantum mechanics, as you said, Dirac notation, all those maths. And it was like confusing. I couldn't get the intuition. I think of like boxes, as you said, and wires. And then I started reading a book and I had this aha moment. Okay, now this makes more sense. So mm-hmm. I do think it's like a really intuitive way, at least for a computer scientist. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think even in a, what you might call a more standard or like a mainstream quantum computing course, it's actually quite fruitful to start drawing circuit diagrams kind of right away. Because that's really giving the idea of what's going on. And the kinds of diagrams we draw are essentially just circuit diagrams, but with some, extra sauce, let's say. So some kind of extra flexibility with what you can do with them. But already, once you start writing things down and you can really see what's going on in sequence and in parallel, I think this gives you the right mental picture of how to think of these processes.
So could you maybe just briefly describe how it is that we represent these processes with these diagrams, please?
I think you already mentioned it's just a box, right, that has some things coming into and out of it. Or is there something more?
I would say that's the baseline. So you have this very, very minimal language of boxes and wires, that you sort of start with. And this language makes sense in any process theory. And then once you sort of fix the process theory, so you fix the thing you're interested in, you know, you could say, I'm interested in quantum processes, or even more specifically, maybe you say, well, I'm interested in quantum processes involving qubits, or even just unitary quantum processes involving qubits. You can start to write down some, now rather than just a black box process, which you're not really assuming anything about, you can write down some specific processes. So something that appears quite a lot in the book are these processes called spiders, which we draw as just, well, it kind of looks like a spider. It's a dot which has some sort of legs curling into it, some legs coming out. And these satisfy some nice rules. So for instance, when spiders of the same color touch each other, they fuse together into a bigger spider, and so on. And you can start to use these rules really to do calculations. So the most well-known at this point collection of such rules is called the ZX calculus. And there you have two kinds of processes. You have the red spiders and the green spiders. And you can put an angle on them, so just a parameter on these processes. And just using these two things, you can represent any linear map, in fact, not just unitrees, but actually any linear map between qubits. So this, using just these two things, you get this kind of universal language for writing processes on qubits, which comes with all these rules that you can start to do calculations on, or start to use for doing calculations on diagrams made out of these special processes.
Okay, so we have a collection of red and green spiders, but how are things like entanglement and superposition represented? Do we still use spiders, or do we use something else?
So there are ways, especially once you fix these special processes, there are ways that you can capture these kinds of concepts as diagram rules. So entanglement, especially maximal entanglement, is something that's even simpler than the spiders. So when I described this kind of zigzag, you know, if I have a kind of a zigzag of wire that I can pull straight, this is meant to indicate some kind of equation between processes, where I have some process which looks like a cup, which like has no inputs and two outputs. So you can imagine a kind of U-shaped piece of wire. And another one that's that upside down, so a kind of a cap shaped piece of wire. And the fact that if I put these together into a zigzag and that equals just a wire, here I'm trying to describe pictures, which yeah. I always tell people not to do. You should just draw the picture, don't tell me. But so this is a very simple equation, and actually this equation It characterizes the fact that this cup-shaped piece of wire is actually a maximally entangled state. So it's if you look at the kind of textbook definition of entanglement, it's not so useful because it's telling you that you can't do something, right? So the point of entanglement is I can't write an entangled state as something tensor something else, right? Or maybe a sum of something's tensor something else. Or a mixture of those things. But that's... Somehow you can't do something positive with that knowledge, right? You can't use the fact that I can't do that really to calculate anything. So somehow if you have this entangled state and you ask, what can I do with it? It's more useful to know what you can do rather than what you can't do. Let's say, and this kind of zigzag thing I described is a useful thing because that says, well, if I have not only an entangled state but a maximally entangled state, here's a thing that it does satisfy. Here's something that I can do with it. And in fact, it's not such a leap from there to say, oh, okay, so if I do have a maximally entangled state, something I can do is use it for quantum teleportation. And I know that because this particular equation holds. So there's versions of this for several, well, actually, yeah, lots of quantum concepts. So also for complementary observables, so where you have a pair of observables which are incompatible with each other, like the kind of analogs of position and momentum kind of things. If you have these in a quantum computing setting, you can actually write this as you build certain processes with these observables, and they satisfy a certain equation. I won't try to say in words what that equation satisfies, but it's also if I drew you the picture, you'd go, okay, that's a simple equation. Once you know that equation, it's actually not such a big leap to say, oh, okay, so once I have two of these things, I can do crypto with them. I can do quantum key distribution. And the reason it works is because this equation is satisfied. And you can give a kind of a full picture proof of BB84, like the first quantum key distribution protocol. There's things like this also for quantum non-locality and various other concepts. A lot of these things we go through in the book, and new things we're kind of finding all the time.
So it sounds like process theory is just a way to make quantum theory make more sense, make it a bit more intuitive. Do you have any idea why it then isn't taught, say, in undergraduate physics? Why is it not taught through that lens?
Just, I don't know, give it 5 years, I guess.
Wait for the book to get a bit more popular.
Yeah, so we're teaching actually now two courses at Oxford in this style. Both are fourth year or master's style courses. So I mean, if I was designing a curriculum from scratch, I would really say that this is your first exposure to quantum mechanics would be with the pictures. Mm. And then later maybe teach Dirac notation so that you can read these papers that are written in Dirac notation, you know, just for completeness sake, let's say. But yeah, I don't think there's any particular reason that you couldn't teach a first year student using this kind of technique. And actually, I think taking the pictures as your building block or some kind of hybrid. Sometimes it's useful to use some kind of hybrid of pictures and formulas, so you can really make sums of pictures and so on. This turns out to be, I think, a very useful way to explain concepts like the tensor product, which are a bit slippery to get your head around, especially if you haven't had much of a pure mathematics background or something. So I think this could be a really useful part of, say, an undergrad curriculum.
Yeah, so it sounds like with diagrams, you build intuition. It's a lot more easier for people to build intuition. And then from there, it's easy to jump, say, Dirac notation or something else, because you already have the intuition. And then it's a lot easier to make sense of the mathematics.
Yeah, yeah. So if you read a paper, especially a paper like by me or one of my colleagues, and then you saw that we happened to write some stuff in Dirac notation, then if you already have this established intuition, you could probably go, oh, okay, I can see what picture this person had in their head when they wrote that bit of Dirac notation. Actually, there's kind of a funny comment. So this string diagram notation goes back at least to Penrose. And actually, Penrose is kind of credited for inventing the particular flavor of string diagrams that we use. But in the appendix of he's got this book Spinners in Space Time, and he's got this beautiful appendix where he does with string diagrams a lot of the kinds of calculations that were being done throughout the book. And he says, I'm going to paraphrase now because I'm not looking straight at the quote, but he says something like, you know, this is very useful for private calculation. But it seems impractical because it's difficult to print in the normal way. And if you see what he's done, he's got all of these handwritten pictures that were clearly sort of taped in place at some point and sort of photocopied into the page. So I think the reason that this notation, or at least one of the reasons this notation hasn't been too prevalent yet, is because we had to use typewriters for so many years. And now we have very, very nice tools for communicating in pictures with each other. So this, I think it's no longer useful just for private calculations anymore. If I want to get the pictures in my head to be the pictures in your head, the best thing I should do is just to draw or to typeset a picture and put this sort of straight in my papers and books and so on.
Yeah, it's surprising how things like that are just because of like history and like technology wasn't advanced enough. But then if they had this, we probably would be teaching everything, as you said, in like pictures or stuff.
That's what I think.
Yeah, but yeah, this sounds like a bit like, and again, I see everything with computer science, but it sounds like a bit jumping programming languages. Like in computer science, you're taught a language and then they're saying, okay, when you get the intuition, it's a lot easier to jump through different programming languages because you already have the intuition.
Yeah.
So I guess this is like kind of similar.
It's about building some kind of key, some core competencies with working with this kind of stuff. And a useful thing is if you get used to this idea of using these diagram rules as a way to calculate, then you can also jump process theories. So you're not changing the language, you're changing what the language describes. Okay, so maybe if you've taken my class or something like that, where you're doing quantum theory with these diagrams, and then somebody shows you a paper about electrical circuits. So there is a nice graphical calculus of electrical circuits, really, with resistors and capacitors and this sort of stuff in it. And these satisfy some diagram laws, which are very much like the ones that the quantum processes satisfy. So now if you want to, you know, prove something about a circuit, you know, prove that it does a certain thing, you can use this exact same way of working. So you learn this kind of generic language that applies to several kinds of things, which I guess can be said about lots of kinds of mathematics.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, you're just building abstraction, and like, I don't know, I really like abstraction, and like people, like we always abstract different things, and it's nice when you can abstract things, work then, and then you can always jump between levels.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so changing subject a bit to quantum computing. So I just want to explore a bit how we've talked about this already, but how like picturalism helps in quantum computing. And so to me, quantum computing boils down to rotate, compute, rotate, which was due to Simon in the 90s when he looked at quantum computation.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to ask, so does picturalism make this obvious the way it makes teleportation obvious, or at least does it make it easier to work with?
So I can kind of see the idea behind this statement of rotate, compute, rotate. This idea that a lot of quantum algorithms, especially the ones kind of out of that time, so there's pretty good famous 90s algorithms like Shor and Simon and so on, have this form of, you know, a state preparation and then this huge classical oracle sort of happening in the middle, or you know, a classical function which has been lifted to a quantum circuit in a certain way. So a quantum bit, which is the first rotate, and then the classical bit, and then a quantum measurement, which I guess is the last rotate, and then measure. So the idea that a lot of these algorithms have fundamentally the same shape and they work in the same way, is also, well, you know, it's easy to say things are obvious with hindsight because, you know, we came along much later than these pioneers. But it is obvious when you write down the pictures. So if you look at a picture of, say, the algorithm for the hidden subgroup problem, and you look at a picture of Simon's, or you look at a picture of Deutsch-Josa, you can see that these pictures look basically the same. I mean, there's little tweaks, you know, am I going to measure the output in the X basis or the Z basis and that kind of thing? But the pictures look more or less the same, and also the reasons that they work are all kind of the same. And again, I'm not going to try to describe what the pictures look like, but you'll just have to take my word for that. So there was a series of papers, starting with work of Jamie Vickery and colleagues, who started writing these quantum algorithms using this kind of pictorial form. And now, I mean, this is the way we teach it in the course that's based on picturing quantum processes. And I mentioned that there's going to be two courses now. And the second course, which quantum algorithms and stuff, we're also going to teach more quantum algorithms using this picture, this kind of exact shape of picture that all these algorithms have. But I think, if anything, that's the area that's the least developed in the pictorial approach. I wouldn't claim, again, the pictures are this kind of magic sword that shows you exactly how you should write your algorithms. There's been a lot of very clever and completely non-diagrammatic stuff done there. But I think it's interesting to see if and how the diagrams can help in that setting as well.
I guess when we talk about algorithms, so picturalism is a good abstraction of like the base quantum theory. And as you said, it also like generalizes some of the algorithms. But then you can also use it as just a supplementary thing. So you can have both coexist at the same time, which is nice. So, okay. So let's say now, let's imagine we have a fault tolerant quantum computer and we want to program it. Okay. So quantum picturalism is nice, but it's, I don't know, it's to me at least, like, no, there isn't like a widespread programming language which is graphical. You have some programming languages which are graphical, but it is much easier to maintain, I don't know, and work on code when it is like in text form.
Right.
So how would we use picturalism to like derive a programming language? Would we just like translate the rules, or are we going to basically build some high level abstractions or like completely different languages and then just use picturalism, like as you said, as a supplementary tool to basically guide us along the way and reason about computations?
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways I could answer that. And I've also got an opinion about this, which I think not all proponents of the picture approach would agree with. And that opinion is that I don't think pictures are a good language for programming. I think programming languages are a good language for programming. And it's precisely because of these boring practical things that you say, that code is easy to maintain, and you know, you have version control and debuggers and all this sort of stuff. But that's not to say that pictures can't help us write software. And I think there's two ways that they can do that. One way is specification. So a kind of big dream that I mentioned Stefano Goggioso before, who's working on this book with Bob, and I think some of the other people working in this area see it as a specification language. So you open up your IDE or whatever, you know, your programming tool, your quantum programming tool, and you want to start to specify the program you're writing and then refine this into a proper program. And the way you can specify it is with a picture. So you open up, you know, some kind of graphical environment, and you actually draw the picture. You say, okay, well, this is the protocol I want to implement, or this is the algorithm I want to implement. And I'm not going to fill in any of the details yet. The details will be code, but I know that the thing is going to have this shape, because this is the kind of one true shape of Oracle-based algorithms. And then I'm going to take that specification and start to refine it. And that refinement is ultimately going to be the thing that produces, you know, sequences of gates or sequences of pulses or whatever that run on your quantum computer.
So it's something like UML. Like in like object-oriented programming, you have this UML, which is just used to, say, model class hierarchies and stuff like that. And then you can, from that, it expresses a certain relationship, I guess, between classes. And then you can go from code from there. I know that people in the past have like tried to generate or synthesize code just from UML diagrams.
Yeah. I guess you could see it as playing a sort of an analogous role. The difference between UML and the kinds of diagrams we draw, well, actually, I don't know much about UML, so maybe this isn't a difference. But the diagrams we draw also know a bit more about their semantics, let's say. So they satisfy more equations. So you could, for instance, I could draw like a specification in my protocol, and just using the diagram equations, I can already prove that my protocol works. And this I could take as my kind of test of whether my specification was good in the first place. So maybe you could see it as a kind of a smart version of UML. You know, it's kind of a specification plus, because it kind of knows also how these things interact with each other. But I think so that kind of specification thing, I think, is you know, we won't have it tomorrow. Maybe that's a kind of a big dream for how we want to develop for quantum computers in the future. A place where I think picture realism has been really useful, even now, so not even for fault tolerant stuff, but for NISQ, like noisy intermediate scale quantum devices or these smaller, crappier devices. A place where the graphical approach is really useful is for circuit optimization and other kind of compilation tasks. So this is something that's not even, you know, user facing at all. You know, you would use your quantum programming language to make a circuit, and then the thing that's happening under the hood. So your compiler, which is, you know, taking the circuit, making either a smaller circuit or a circuit which you know is made out of the native gates on your computer or kind of fits in your computer's architecture. It's actually very useful to use these graphical rules for that kind of task, to simplify circuits or to it's called routing circuits, where you make them fit into the shape of an architecture, because it. Not every qubit can sort of do a gate with every other qubit, so you often have to mutate your circuits to kind of fit that. I think these graphical rules are quite useful and quite powerful, and you can come up with kind of automated strategies for doing these kinds of tasks, and it seems to work quite well. Though it's almost counterintuitive to the idea that the diagrams are something that humans understand better, because here it's actually you're using the diagrams under the hood. The human maybe never even needs to see them. But it turns out that, you know, actually computers understand these things better too, because I mean the structure is basically a graph, and you know a graph is often a very good structure for these kinds of programming tasks. Because it really captures the relevant information.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like the diagrams, as you said, like meant to be like looked at by humans, are actually useful. And yeah, I think it's exactly as you said. It's because like the graphs actually capture structure as well as things, and that's also very useful. And computers can exploit that structure.
Mm-hmm.
So can you, for example, can you go from a circuit to a diagram of some sort, which is like picturalism or like ZX calculus?
Yeah. So this is actually there's an easy direction and a hard direction, and this is the easy direction. So if I have a quantum circuit, I can immediately make a ZX calculus diagram out of that. And that's just because there's ZX diagrams are a generalization of circuits, so they're kind of circuits, but more. There's kind of more things that you can write which don't correspond to circuits. But there's actually, if you go through kind of quantum gate by gate through a circuit, there is a little piece of ZX diagram which would correspond to that gate. And in fact, the thing that comes out looks quite a lot like the circuit you started with. But it's really a graph. So now, for instance, if I have a controlled NOT gate, this becomes something which just looks like two nodes of different colors, which are connected to each other, which somehow still looks like a CNOT gate. Like if you see that written on the page, and all of your one qubit gates just look like little one spider ZX diagrams. So that way is easy. The hard part is so you can imagine, so a way that we do optimization, so taking big circuits and trying to squeeze them into smaller circuits which do the same thing, one of the techniques we use is we take the circuit, turn it into a ZX diagram, do all of our simplification on that diagram. So now I have this graph thing, and I can apply many more rules to it than I could the circuit. So I do the simplification there, and I try to get a circuit back out. And it's the getting a circuit back out which is the kind of subtle part, because you could by the time you're done, you have this graph with nodes, and they're just connected to each other in lots of sort of arbitrary ways. Now the question is, you know, how the hell is this thing a circuit? You know, how am I going to find the gates which represent this? And the general case is hard, I think. And I think it's maybe even hard with a capital H, that you can maybe prove some sort of complexity theoretic result. Like, you know, if I can do this in a totally general case, then post-selected quantum computing is sort of equivalent to quantum computing. Like post-BQP and BQP would collapse, I think. This is a conjecture that I've had for a long time now, but I don't know enough complexity theory to try to prove it. So the general case, I think, is hard, but the specific case for the kinds of simplifications we're doing, we know how to do it. And the reason we know how to do that is because the graphs which come out of this procedure aren't just any old graph. They satisfy certain properties, certain graph theoretic properties. And we can exploit that to get a circuit back out. It's not that simple. So this is not just a matter of kind of drawing the picture for you. But there is an algorithm which kind of efficiently extracts a circuit out of these kinds of special graphs. And it uses a property which is called generalized flow, which came out of measurement-based quantum computing. So there's a lot of analogs between what goes on in ZX land and in MBQC in measurement-based quantum computing. And actually we borrow/steal a lot of things from there. And hopefully I think sort of re-export kind of interesting stuff back into that field of MBQC. So yeah, maybe that was a long answer to a simple question. But
oh, no.
So one way is easy, and one way is kind of non-trivial. So
yeah, but that's still, like as you said, you still have like heuristic approaches, I guess, and you have like tools to do the job, so you still can do it, and it's improving. Yeah.
Yeah. So we. In fact, the way we do it now, we thought it was a heuristic, so we just coded it up, and we were like, okay, well, maybe this will work sometimes, and then it was working every time. So we were like, oh, that's strange. Maybe there's a good reason this is working. So we started thinking about it. We talked to Simon Perdri, who's an expert in measurement-based quantum computing. He said, oh, it probably has something to do with generalized flow. And then we figured out that was indeed the case. But I quite like this way of working, you know, rather than proving a theorem, you think something, you know, might be true. So you just write some code and then you, figure out why the hell it worked afterwards.
So I was wondering if we could talk about this new book you've got coming out, Picturing Quantum Software. Yeah, could you just tell us what it's about and why you decided to write it?
So this is in some sense it's a sequel to Picturing Quantum Processes, but I not in a strict sense. So in fact we're writing it in such a way that somebody with a more traditional quantum computing background could also pick this thing up. So if you read Nielsen and Chuang, you should be able to pick up this book as well and just start reading it. It's kind of, whereas Picturing Quantum Processes was building quantum theory from the ground up, and exploring lots of different aspects of that. Picturing Quantum Software is drilling more into, sort of specific aspects of quantum software and particularly quantum compilation. So this problem of given a description of an algorithm or say maybe like a Hamiltonian you want to simulate or something like that, how do you go all the way from that down to, well, we won't go down as far as say pulses, but at least down to the kind of the hardware level or at least the hardware gate level. And how much of that can we explain just purely using pictures? it's going to connect a lot more to other things which have also been used to study the structure of quantum circuits. So the kind of the big three kind of things in the book that the book uses are ZX calculus, which I've already talked about some, and then stabilizer theory, which underlies a lot of quantum, you know, quantum simulation, classical simulation, and also quantum error correcting codes, and the theory of phase polynomials. So this is something that's been used a lot lately in quantum circuit optimization as a way to understand certain families of quantum circuits. And it turns out, if you introduce ZX first, that this is a very nice way of teaching both stabilizer theory and phase polynomials. These are very, very clear what's going on using the ZX kind of language. So this book introduces those things and then drills into some specific topics like synthesizing circuits to some specification or doing circuit optimization. Possibly some things about classical simulation, possibly some things about error correcting codes. I say possibly because because this book is still kind of fairly early days. It's just been accepted by the publisher, I think that its first dry run is we'll be using it sort of as the lecture notes for this upcoming course called Quantum Software that we're teaching at Oxford this year. So yeah, I wish I could tell you, you know, next month go down and pick it up, but I know, having written a book before, that I'll make no estimates whatsoever about how long it's going to take to actually finish. So
I have a very important question about your book. Do you have a mascot? I know the picturing quantum process has the daughter.
I think this is a very important, an important question. In fact, maybe the most pressing question of the new book. What will be the successor of the dodo? So if you see picturing quantum processes on the shelf, it's a big pink and purple book that has a big purple dodo on the cover of it. That's Dave the dodo, who features very prominently throughout the book in most of the examples. I was going to say two contradictory things. One is that the mascot is top secret, but in fact, the other thing is I'm open to suggestions for for a new mascot. So clearly, it's not decided yet.
Huh. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, if anybody has any suggestions, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think this is a good place to wrap things up. Thank you a lot for being a guest on our podcast, and I really enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, thanks, Alex.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, thank you.